The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
The Nicole Sandler Show. Questioning authority daily. And that could be the very reason why YouTube is upset. Hey, YouTube. The music bed you hear beneath my voice is from a broadcast sound library that I paid for and have the receipts. So I've got your copyright violation right here. And now, here's Nicole.
Oh, well, we made it to a Friday, but just barely. Oh, boy, welcome to it. I'm Nicole Sandler. Thank you for joining us. We are live at 3 p.m. Eastern, heard on the Progressive Voices Network, hopefully at 5 Eastern. We're working on that. Just so you know, the piece of equipment that I need to be able to take this show live on Progressive Voices at 5 Eastern just arrived. So we'll spend the next few days trying to set it up and test, and hopefully in the next week or two we'll move the show, and that will do away with the, you know, the live or the dead air that happens occasionally at the top of the rebroadcast on Progressive Voices. Okay. I think I started with that because I'm so uncomfortable with what is happening in our country today. What a shit show we are living. The Orange Menace just had what was billed as a press conference in the Rose Garden, at which he made a ridiculous statement about China and the World Health Organization, basically disowning them both, and then left without taking any questions. Hey, dump. It's not a press conference if you don't take any questions. And the reason he didn't take any questions is because the idiot tried to walk back his incendiary tweet from last night, in which he said, when the looting starts, the shooting starts. Ugh, what a piece of shit this man is. We do have good news, though, to start the day with. The good news is that Derek Chauvin has been arrested and charged with third-degree murder and manslaughter. And in case you're not familiar with the name, you're familiar with his knee, because it was his knee on George Floyd's neck that killed him, that murdered him. And this is the attorney for Hennepin County, Minnesota, just about an hour or so, announcing the arrest.
Former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin has been charged by the Hennepin County Attorney's Office with murder and with manslaughter. Questions?
Yes, what charge of murder?
He has been charged with third-degree murder. We are in the process of continuing to review the evidence. There may be subsequent charges later. I failed to share with you. A detailed complaint will be made available to you this afternoon. I didn't want to wait any longer to share the news that he's in custody and has been charged with murder.
What about the other three officers involved?
Good question.
The investigation is ongoing. We felt it appropriate to focus on the most dangerous perpetrator. I must say that this case has moved with extraordinary speed. This conduct, this criminal action, took place on Monday evening, May 25th, Memorial Day. I'm speaking to you at 1 o'clock on Friday, May 29th.
So, and they went on, he went on to talk about how it usually, the average amount of time it takes to arrest a police officer is something on the order of 9 months. Why? Because he's a cop? I'm sorry. I was having this conversation with my daughter yesterday. We need to have much better mental health screening for candidates for the police academy. For anybody who wants the position of police officer, they need to do a thorough psychological workup on these people to find out why, what is motivating them. Because I'll tell you, in too many towns where I've lived, I've come up against real asshole cops. And I think part of it is, and I hate to generalize, to those good cops out there, and I know there are many of you, I apologize, but you need to do your part to get rid of the bad apples, the bad seeds, or whatever, the bad ones, the ones all hopped up on the roids, because I see them here in Coral Springs, Florida. They're aggressive, they're mean, and they're usually short and really stocky. And you could tell, that they, you know, they take the steroids, trying to pump up those muscles. Ugh. You know it affects their minds. So the governor of Minnesota spoke a little while ago as well. I may get to that. And yes, they carry guns. They carry guns. There needs to be a much higher standard for people who have apparently the power of life and death over us. They certainly have the power to arrest us. Look, I've been there. I've been at the mercy of a power-hungry Broward County sheriff's official, sheriff's deputy. I guess they're all deputies, in the Broward County jail. Like 4 or 5 years ago, or maybe more, 6 years ago, something like that, I was arrested because I went to something that was billed as a town hall meeting with a man who was at the time my congressman, Alan West, who just had a bad motorcycle accident. I guess it wasn't bad enough. Sorry, I have no love lost for Alan West, who this was right after they voted to privatize Medicare. And I'm there in the audience, you know, raising my hand, trying to ask a question. And he didn't call on me, but I was right in the second row, right in front of him, right behind his wife, by the way. And I shouted out when he said, we're protecting Medicare for future generations. And finally, I said, how is it protecting Medicare when you want to privatize it? You want to turn it into a profit-making venture. And of course, an off-duty cop escorted me out. They put me in jail. And long story short, while I was in custody, they mistreated a few of us, locked us in a room and left us there for a couple of hours and forgot about us. And when I demanded an apology, I was stuck in a cell by myself. You could call it solitary confinement. I was only there for a few hours, but I knew my husband had come to bail me out and they wouldn't let me out. And when finally the door to my cell opened and I stepped out and the deputy told me to get back in and I begged him not to make me go back in, he maced me. These people think that, like Donald Trump, he thinks he's the dictator of the world. Now, put aside the fact that he wasn't actually elected president because he lost the popular vote by about 3 million votes, but he thinks that that being president affords him the powers of the you name it, Vladimir Putin. Sorry, we're not there yet, but we're headed there. Look at what's happened in this country in this week alone. It is sickening, and I got to tell you, I've just been beaten up. Oh, people are calling me Karen on Twitter. Like I'm supposed to be offended by that. I'm like, no, sorry. The name's Nicole. No Karen here. And so finally I had to ask, what is this Karen thing? And apparently Karen is a new smear for white women who are like the idiot in the park the other day who called the cops on the black man who was a bird watcher who nicely asked her to leash her dog. So I'm a Karen because I tweeted out something this morning about the fact that I should find the original tweet so I don't misquote myself, because I hate it when people misquote me. So I certainly don't want to misquote myself. So let me find find what I wrote. see if I can. It's been a busy day on the Twitters. I said something along the lines of, it's coming. This is what I wrote. I don't care how awful Joe Biden is at this point, and he is, I put in parentheses, he's not even in the same reprehensible universe as Donald Trump. We're in an emergency. It's all hands on deck to get Twitler out of office in November. Keep attacking Biden and I'll block you. I am not a Joe Biden fan. And someone said to me, what did Joe Biden do? And I'm like, really, how long have you got? I can give you hundreds of things, but I'm not going to, because right now my energy is focused on getting Trump out of office. When Joe Biden wins, And hopefully it's with Elizabeth Warren as his vice president and decent people surrounding him. Then we work on Joe Biden. But right now, the most important thing is getting that maniac out of office who last night tweeted that when the looting starts, the shooting starts. And this after fucking police murdered a man on Monday. And there was another one in Tallahassee this week. It's just insane. So these idiots who on Twitter who are calling me a Karen, by the way, call me Karen all you want. I don't give a shit. My block button is very easy to work. But really, yeah, this is what you do. This is your defense because you don't like the fact that I say, sorry, we do need to vote for the lesser of two evils in this case. Yes, I'll take Biden any day of the week over Donald Trump. So that makes me a Karen. I've got worse words for them than Karen, and I use them regularly. Oh, my God. So today, I'm always excited to talk to John Nichols. John Nichols is the national correspondent for The Nation magazine, and John Nichols has a new book out. It's actually not so new. It's been out a couple of months already, but it came out the beginning of April while we were all in quarantine. So there was little fanfare about it, but the book is called The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party: The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Policies. And this is a really important time for a book like this. And I love John Nichols. I could talk to him for hours and hours and hours if given the opportunity. Anyway, well, he'll join us today, but I called today's show Fighting for the Soul of Our Nation, because that's where we are. The soul of our nation, if we are to survive as a nation, it's got to be in a post-Trump world. And all of these so-called progressives, these people who claim to be Bernie Sanders supporters, if you love Bernie so much, as I do and have for over a decade, I'm not one of the late comers to the party who just discovered him when he ran for president. I've interviewed Bernie Sanders at least a dozen times over the years. I'm proud to call him a friendly acquaintance anyway. He's telling you, you need to get over it and vote against Donald Trump, who is the most dangerous president in the history of our world. And if you don't get that, then there's something really wrong with you. And if you want to lash out at me and call me a Karen because I dare to express those sentiments, well, then fuck you. You know what? Fuck you and fuck you again. I got a song for you. God. All right. So John Nichols will be joining us at the bottom of the hour, and we've got a lot to talk to him about. I'm already getting riled up, and I'm going to get more riled up when I show you what I watched happen on television this morning shortly after 6 o'clock, because I wake up early, and if I'm not up already, I have a dog that gets me up. But it was moments after 6 o'clock watching CNN when the cops in Minneapolis arrested the reporter who was live on the air and his crew. And then later on, the Minnesota State Police tweeted something. Oh, we apologize for arresting this journalist. As soon as we knew those were journalists, we let them go. The technical word for that is
bullshit.
It's bullshit. Sorry, you can't bullshit a bullshitter. And the answer to Jeffrey Cal in the YouTube chat room, yes, it is, Jeffrey. Yes, it is. All right. Before we go any further and I blow a head gasket, let me play today's funny, because, you know, I love doing this. Oh, and I meant to look and see. I found another really talented guy on the YouTubes who's done a few of these parody videos. You know, people are entertaining themselves and us while in lockdown. And this video, the COVID prison blues, only has, maybe a couple of hundred listens, fewer likes. And it's been up for a week or two already. So as I do every day, I will post this video on my blog at NicoleSandler.com/today/5-29-20, because today is May 29th, 2020, and I'll post the video. But I'll tell you right now, the artist's name is Jamal Cox. He's got his YouTube channel. I'll post the link to it. And Jamal Cox, just so you know, plays on the video, for those only here in the audio stream, plays every single instrument being played and sings, and it is the lone person in this video. So keeping all that in mind, let's go to Jamal Cox and the COVID prison blues.
Well, I hear Big Rona coming, it's rolling round the bend, and I ain't seen the outside since I don't know when. I'm stuck in COVID prison, time keeps dragging on, but old Rona keeps rolling while I'm stuck at home. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't cough on folks for fun. But I smacked a man in Walmart, 'cause he got too close. When I hear my neighbor coughing, I know that there's no fancy dining bar. They're probably drinking coffee and smoking big cigars. They don't know Big Rona's coming. I know I can't be free.
Big Rona?
But those people keep moving. That's what tortures me. The doctor said it's fine, I bet I'd move it on a little farther down the line. Far from COVID prison, that's where I want to stay. Then I'd let that girl from Tinder blow my blues away.
Woo! That was the best line of all. Oh my goodness. Yeah. Okay. The best line. Whoops. I guess it would help if I did this. The best line of all. I'll let that girl from Tinder blow my blues away. I love creative people. And that's the wonderful thing. That's one of the few silver linings of this whole COVID quarantine, is people are getting their creativity on. Good stuff. His name is Jamal Knox, K-N-O-X, Jamal Knox, and his COVID prison blues. I especially like him standing in the shower playing the bass, and he played the drums, and he played the guitar, and he did the singing. That girl from Tinder, so funny. All right, now let's go to something not so funny. I got to share this with you, because yes, I was watching CNN this morning, you know, wiping the sleep from my eyes, and was just watched this unfold. So before, I'm going to play the video for you. What happened, for those of you who didn't see this morning, CNN, it was 5 in the morning, Minneapolis time, 6 a.m. here. The sun was already up or just rising in Minneapolis. 5:09 a.m., it says, Central Time. You'll see when this video begins playing. In fact, let me bring it over for those of you watching on YouTube or Facebook Live or Periscope. Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us. So this journalist, this reporter, is there doing a live shot on CNN. And you can see all the cops gathered around him. And this man, this reporter, was very deferential to the cops. It was Omar Jimenez is his name. And, well, you'll see. You'll hear. Here we go.
What I want to make sure is not lost in this, as we're seeing these remarkable pictures with this law enforcement presence directly behind you, is
that's John Berman in the studio talking to him.
Why people have been out on the streets protesting.
Well, we know why.
This violence is taking place. There is some action behind you. Hang on.
Yep. We've got one person being arrested here. We've got...
You hear them right away saying, we're from CNN.
I got you. Hold on. They had us here.
This is the reporter.
We're speaking with State Patrol right now.
Omar Jimenez.
Second, guys. We can move back to where you'd like. We can move back to where you'd like here. We are live on the air at the moment.
He's telling them, we're from CNN. We're live. We'll go where you
this
want us to go. Tell us where to go.
Team.
He's explaining everything to them.
Just... Put us back where you want us. We are getting out of your way, so just let us know.
Nice fuck there on the screen
on
CNN.
Wherever you'd want us, we will go.
Unbelievable what went on there last night.
We're advancing through the intersection. So just let us know.
Let us know. We'll get out of your way. And the cops are just standing there, dead-faced, not talking to him, because, oh, my God.
This is a scene here.
It would really hurt to talk to someone.
Part of the advanced police presence that we saw come over the course of really minutes when the local police showed up at the fire department, or with the fire department, I should say, on that building we showed you that was burning.
And he's holding his press pass in his hand.
Unit that was advancing up the street, saying and scattering the protesters at that point for people to clear the area. And so we walked away. I'm sorry?
You're under arrest.
You're under arrest?
Whoa, 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 whoa. Why I'm under arrest, sir.
What? For
why,
what?
Why
and they don't say
arrest,
anything. Not a word.
Okay.
So he puts his mic down. And that's a producer in the background saying, we're live on CNN. You're arresting him live on CNN? And all these cops in their riot gear
just
are just standing
in,
there. And this is Allison Camerata and John Berman in the studio talking now.
Jimenez being arrested by state police in Minnesota. We're not sure why.
This
our
is
correspondent is being
arrested. My jaw was on the floor.
Let's listen into what these officers are saying.
And so now you'll hear in a moment the cameraman picks up the microphone and he starts telling them what's going on. So they've led Omar Jimenez away in handcuffs.
Omar Jimenez being led away by police officers. He clearly identified himself as a reporter.
Yes, he did.
He was respectfully explaining to the state police that our CNN team was there and moving away as they would request. And then for some reason, he was just taken in to police custody live on television.
Live on television.
I'm
but
sorry,
wait,
I didn't mean to interrupt you.
There's more.
Here.
Because the cops are coming back now, and then they're going to arrest the producer and the cameraman.
Yeah. We're trying to see what's going to happen, John, obviously, to the rest.
I'm about to, guys.
This is the cameraman speaking now.
We were just out here reporting the closure of the streets. They just, Omar was just arrested. I believe they're about to, we're all about to be arrested. That's
yep, and now you see the producer being handcuffed with his mask and all, being handcuffed and led away.
Our CNN producer is being...
I'm probably going to be taken in a minute.
And this is the cameraman talking.
Our CNN camera crew and our producer are being arrested right now on live television in handcuffs.
I've never seen anything like this.
No, none of us have ever seen anything like this. And he's asking, why are you arresting us? And they're not answering.
Your message.
And you'll see. So then he puts down his camera because he's a cameraman. He's carrying the camera. And the cops start carrying the camera away, not realizing that it's still rolling. And this is all going out live on the air. And here's the cameraman.
Can I put the camera down?
Right now, being arrested, putting the camera down. This is just incredible. And so it went on like this. I'm not going to keep it rolling. I will post all the whole video again on the blog today at NicoleSandler.com so you can watch the whole thing for yourself. It goes on for another, I don't know, two or three minutes. That's it. The cops won't tell them why they're arrested, won't tell them what the charges are. They don't talk to them at all. And then, as I mentioned, like an hour or two later, the Minnesota State Police, and these apparently were state police, put out a tweet saying something ridiculous. In fact, wait, I think I, oh, no, I don't. This is not it. I thought this was it. But saying, oh, as soon as we knew that they were with the media and CNN, we released them. Bullshit. It's just, that's a flat out lie. And this is where we are as a nation, because the president or the resident, however you look at him, is a pathological liar. He can't open his mouth without spewing lies. And his party, the Republicans, let him get away with it. And they just back him up. They provide him cover. So now it's okay to lie. It's okay to lie. It's unreal. So the governor apparently last night called Jeff Zucker, or this morning, sorry, hours are all confused, called Jeff Zucker, the head of CNN, and personally apologized. And then he made a speech today. He made a statement, and at which he, I'm not going to play it now because we don't have time. He addressed the arrest and apologized sincerely and made some really good remarks about the necessity of a free press and how this is never to happen. But you know what? It did. It happened under his watch. And he said, I take full blame for it because it was my project. The whole thing is fucked up. And we need to reassess our priorities in this country because they are FUBAR. And, you know, am I happy that Joe Biden is going to be the person that the Democrats put up to defeat Donald Trump? Fuck no. Do I think he's going to have a really hard time winning? Hell yeah. Because he's the wrong guy. But he's the only guy that can, in our perverted two-party system, possibly win. If there's a third-party candidate, it's going to take votes away from Biden and help propel Trump to a second term. And I'll tell you this, if Donald Trump somehow wins re-election, we're done. This nation is done. Well, we'll probably all die out because we'll all get COVID and die. At least they'll thin the herd, right? And the way it's going, you know, it's those Trump states. And I feel bad. I know we've got listeners in Arkansas and Montana and South Dakota and Wyoming and Iowa and, you know, some of those very red states. I want you guys to stay safe, but let the rest of them kill each other off. If they want to go to North Carolina in August and have a packed to the rafters convention, I say let them do it. But then keep them in there for the 14 days afterwards so they can all incubate together and then, you know, kill each other off and leave the country to the rest of us who are willing to turn it around and do the hard work necessary to turn it around. And it is hard work necessary. Look, we see just how staying indoors for the last 2.5 months has done wonders for the planet, right? It's turned around the canals in Venice so much that there are dolphins frolicking in the waters, which aren't as disgusting as they usually are. It's bringing back wildlife. It's the haze over the country you can see from satellites has cleared a bit. But don't worry, because in a couple of months of America back to normal, we'll be back to destroying the planet. Everything is fucked up. And, you know, not to sound too pessimistic, but I am. I really feel like these are end times. Again, those who know me know I'm not a religious person. I don't believe in the Bible. I certainly don't believe in organized religion. I don't believe in the concept of an Antichrist. But throughout the 8 years of Obama's presidency, I heard all these Republicans and religious people telling me that Barack Obama was the Antichrist because the Antichrist was going to come and he's going to be this charismatic figure that has people following him. And okay, it wasn't Obama, but it could be Donald Trump. He's the anti-everything. He is the man who can bring us down. And when I say us, I don't mean just this country. I'm talking about the whole fucking planet. So it is all hands on deck time. And it is time to figure out the soul, not only of the Democratic Party, but of the entire country. Because we really need to, something's got to change. If we continue on this trajectory, we're all fucked and not in a good way. All right, with that, I'm calling John Nichols right now. John Nichols, of course, is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine. He also writes in a number of other places like The Progressive and In These Times. He's the author of a number of books, including The Death and Life of American Journalism, The Genius of Impeachment, The S Word, and his newest book is called The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's anti-fascist, anti-racist politics. Oh, John Nichols, hello and welcome to the show, and thank you so much for being here today.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, my friend.
I'm on a roll, but what a week this has been, John Nichols. I as I was just ranting because I couldn't help myself any longer, I really fear for the future of the country. You know, your book is The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. I think we're in a fight, and that is a fight that we're having and that we need to have. But I think the even bigger fight right now is the soul for this nation and whether or not it lives on or, you know, goes away.
Well, I think this nation will survive. It's just the quality of that survives. Whether it takes the turn it needs to away from some unimaginably bad politics in the moment, and also, frankly, you know, toward addressing the issues that we've long left unaddressed, that's the open question. And I'm probably about as scared as you are. Mm-hmm. I worry a lot about a couple of things. First off, the way in which we leave fundamental issues unaddressed, and then they come back to haunt us in the most profound ways. And that's clearly true with structural racism, police violence, police brutality. We're seeing that just in the last couple of days, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And then also the way in which, frankly, our media is manipulated by and exploited by Donald Trump and people like him. And when you put those things together, you get a very volatile circumstance. And I think that is what we are looking at right now. It is sometimes hard to keep up with all of the fundamental challenges that are coming our way.
Yeah. Oh, it most definitely is. You know, one of the challenges, look, I was so fed up this morning and so disgusted that I made one of my tweets just sort of shaking my finger at everyone. And I said, look, I'm not thrilled that Joe Biden, I don't have it in front of me, but basically, yes, I'm not happy that Joe Biden is the nominee. I don't care how awful he is. And he is. We need to vote to get Donald Trump out of office, basically is what I said. And for my troubles, I've been called name. I didn't know that Karen was a dirty word, but apparently it's a pejorative for white women.
Apparently, and I feel for the many Karens.
Yeah, so do I. So, but I've been called a Karen by people today who are self-proclaimed progressives and Bernie Sanders supporters who just cannot vote for Joe Biden, even if it's to take Donald Trump out. I just don't understand. And so this is how they fight back. They call me a name. My name's Nicole, not Karen. You can call me whatever you want, I guess. But really? So you stoop to Trumpian levels and name-calling in order to fight back? And if you're such a big Bernie Sanders fan, why don't you listen to what the man is saying? And we need to get Donald Trump out of office because he's the most dangerous president in our lifetimes.
Yeah, and I think he can reconcile these two things. I happen to be in the camp that says that you can remain a Bernie Sanders fan, mm-hmm. and you can still see the fundamental necessity to get rid of Donald Trump.
Got to get rid of Donald Trump.
And in fact, to be honest, one of the arguments I make in the book, and frankly, one of the arguments I make more broadly in a lot of what I write, is that you need that progressive flank, challenging, mm-hmm. objecting, mm-hmm. pushing, not just jumping on board and saying, oh, yeah, this is the greatest thing going, acknowledging the flaws, but also, you know, seeking to make better, in this case, the preferable nominee.
Right.
That being the nominee, frankly, whoever the Democratic nominee would be, you would be the preferable nominee over Donald Trump. And I worry sometimes that we lose sight of the vital importance of addressing the immediate threats that we face, and doing so with some perspective. And that means that we can say at the same time, yeah, it's good to get rid of Trump. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, that the Democratic Party needs to fundamentally change and become a much more progressive party.
Without a doubt.
Those two thoughts can be reconciled.
Uh-huh. Well, the book, John Nichols, is The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. Unfortunately, it was published the beginning of April when we were all sort of shut in, so it's been sort of a subdued release. But I'm glad I have the chance to talk to you about it, because we are at this crossroads, I guess, in the Democratic Party, but that we've been here before. And your book begins with, the preface is why we concern ourselves with the history of political parties. And, well, why do we, John Nichols?
Well, because political parties are not static. They change, they evolve. And if we understand political parties, we often get the answers to the very frustrating questions we face as regards politicians. We wonder why politicians fall short, why they don't do the things that we expected them to do. And very often it is because there is, and I say this as politely as I can, a rot within political parties, i.e. that they are disinclined to be bold. They are disinclined to push for big change. And thus, when maybe a change agent is elected, somebody that you're very excited about, and you really think they're going to make fundamental change, they don't have a movement behind them. They don't have a movement party that says, yeah, we got to go do this. Mm-hmm. Now, the interesting thing is that the Republican Party has become a movement of a sort. And it's scary. It's extreme. It's wrongheaded, to my view. But they, at least you know what you're going to get.
Right.
If you elect a Republican president, you are going to get very right-wing judges.
That's right. And they're doing, look, they're trying to talk Clarence Thomas into retiring early so that Trump can replace him on the Supreme Court. Now, keep in mind that we're 6 months away from the election, not a year where we were when Scalia died and Mitch McConnell and the Republicans wouldn't let Obama replace it. And he said, okay, I guess I'll just sit here and twiddle my thumbs, which really still pisses me off.
In fairness to Obama, he did try. I mean,
he
made an argument. Yeah, I think he made an effort there. But the fact of the matter is that when you don't have a movement party, that goes to the mat overall on these things, it often doesn't matter how good a speech a president makes.
Right.
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 And so I am of the camp that says that political parties have to have, they have to believe in something. They have to be about something. And so when I was writing the book, you know, with this question of why we concern ourselves with the history of political parties, I started out thinking about Trump. I wanted to figure out how Trump became possible in our politics.
Uh-huh.
And initially that led me to think about writing about the Republican Party. But more and more I came to the conclusion that you get a Trump when there's a void. Right. When
mm-hmm.
you don't have a sufficient alternative. Right.
Yeah.
And where there's some space open that shouldn't be open. And so I started to look at the Democratic Party and I started to ask this question of
why was the party that Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal proved to be so successful with, the party that for actually decades afterwards kind of traded on the strength of the New Deal.
Yeah.
And frankly, a party that at one time, 75 years ago, 80 years ago, seemed to be the visionary force in our politics, the definitional visionary force in our politics. Why did it cease to be that? Why did it become a softer force, a force that people could really say, oh, there's not much difference between Democrats and Republicans?
Money.
Now I happen to think there's a lot more difference. Money is a big part of the answer, but also a status quo that is inclined toward seeking power without purpose. And this is a big deal. You want the power to govern so that you can actually do big things. Mm. When you have a party that simply wants the power to govern but doesn't seem to have an inclination to do big things, that's where problems come into play. And so it is absurd that the Democratic Party hasn't been fighting for 75 years for single-payer Medicare for all.
Uh-huh.
It's not. It shouldn't be a new idea,
no.
Right?
No, and it isn't.
It is absurd,
right,
that the Democratic Party has come to power repeatedly over the years and not overturned Taft-Hartley and mm-hmm. gotten rid of the barriers to labor union organizing in this country.
Yep.
It is absurd that the Democratic Party, that relies overwhelmingly on African-American votes and the votes of Latinos and others, hasn't had a full court press agenda on behalf of racial justice mm-hmm. as well as economic and social justice. I mean, and that includes criminal justice reform and all the other elements of that vision. So, you know, what you're really talking about is a Democratic Party that left so much space, right, that our politics began to drift away from it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not trying to suggest that people decide to go vote for Trump. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is it's just that there wasn't a sufficient contrast in the minds of some people even to come and vote.
Right. Well,
so
because part of that,
shockingly low turnout election.
Yeah. Well, part of that is because so many people feel like the politicians, the candidates, don't speak to them. I get why progressives are repelled by the idea of voting for Joe Biden. Frankly, I'll be voting against Donald Trump, or hopefully I'll be voting for Vice President Elizabeth Warren. My vote will not be for Joe Biden, but it'll be for the future of this nation to get rid of the madman, psychopath, narcissist, megalomaniac who's occupying the Oval Office right now. I think it's that important. But then let's get back to the Democratic Party, where I feel like I don't have a home here because it seems like my wants and needs are ignored by the power players within the party. And right now, it's the elder guard. It's the Chuck Schumers and Nancy Pelosi's who, frankly, I think it's time for them to move on because the candidates they're choosing, especially Chuck Schumer, to be the U.S. Senate Democratic nominees, are not the ones I want. And he doesn't understand that it's about letting the people vote. We can look at Colorado, where there's a primary for the Senate race. The party, Chuck Schumer, has anointed John Hickenlooper. He's our candidate. Well, no, there's still a primary taking place in a few weeks. And frankly, I'd rather see Andrew Romanoff in there. But Chuck Schumer says, no, he's our guy. That's not what the Democratic Party is supposed to be about, is it?
Absolutely. Look, this is a huge problem, and I write a lot about it in the book. Again and again and again, throughout the last 75 years, since, you know, the end of FDR's tenure, there's been an effort to push aside the visionaries.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, many of these people are progressives, but the bottom line is, when you push aside the more progressive candidate, you're not just pushing aside, you know, somebody who's ideologically in a certain place. Usually you are pushing aside someone who is saying, here's what needs to be done now. Here's what's necessary. This is what we have to be about.
Mm-hmm.
And you're pushing them aside for someone who says, oh, maybe we can do it a little softer, maybe do a little less.
Right.
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 And so you have, in the case of my book, you know, 1944, Henry Wallace.
Mm-hmm.
Saying that racism was a form of Americanized fascism, saying that we had to not just win the war abroad, but then come home and win a fight against racism and segregation and the poll tax and discrimination in the United States, saying that in 1944, wow. saying that we had to have an equal rights amendment for women, and that the women who had gone into the industries during World War II needed to be protected so that they could have jobs and economic security, just like men, in the aftermath of World War II. Talking about a massive employment program so mm-hmm. that the vets who came home could have jobs. Talking about a housing program so that families, you know, who had really put their lives on hold during the war could start to get housing. He had a big, bold agenda. They pushed him aside, and they replaced him with Harry Truman. Not a horrible guy.
Right.
But with a much softer agenda, mm-hmm. much weaker agenda. And you know what happened in 1946? They lost their congressional authority.
Yep.
For the first time since 1932.
Wow.
Right? And then so you say, oh, well, that's just one example, John. There, you know, that's an oddball thing. You know, maybe Wallace was a bad guy or Truman was better than you think or whatever. No. 1976, Jimmy Carter gets elected over more progressive candidates, right?
Yep.
Comes in to govern, talks about national malaise and things like that. He's a decent man who we love now, but as president was quite unfocused. 1978, loses a lot of his congressional authority, very weakened by the midterm elections. 1992, Bill Clinton becomes president of the United States. He's got solid House and Senate majorities. He does NAFTA and issues that deeply offend the labor base that did so much to elect him. 1994, a lot of people stay home. Clinton loses his governing power in Congress.
Wow. Wow.
2008, Barack Obama, elected as a visionary figure and somebody who excited and engaged Aww. So many people, does some great things, right? And I give him credit for many of the things he did, but it, you know, is not sufficient to excite, mobilize, energize. And in 2010, he loses his governing power because the Congress shifts. And, you know, how does that happen again and again and again? You can blame Truman, or you could blame Carter, or you could blame Clinton, or you could blame Obama. I don't. Well, I have criticisms of these figures along the way. I blame a Democratic Party that doesn't say, when you get elected president of the United States, here's the things we're going to do.
Yeah.
And it's at a certain, if it's all about personalities, right? If it's just, oh, here's this wonderful person, or here's this better person, what we lose sight of is that voting for a party ought to mean something. Conservatives actually believe voting Republican means something.
Yeah,
right.
Right?
And you know, that people always wrestle with this question. Why do, you know, Christian fundamentalists, you know, people who, you know, really do are very, very strict in their interpretation of the Bible and how you should live your life. How could they possibly vote for Donald Trump? Right.
Right.
You know, multiple marriages, you know, scandals, the whole bit. Well, it's not hard at all because they're not voting for Donald Trump. They're voting for a Republican president. They know what it means to have a Republican president, period.
Yeah.
And you just put the candidate in. They know what they're going to get. They're going to get their judges. They're going to get, you know, in the case of other players, perhaps corporate types, they get
exactly
what they get.
And you can say that the Republicans, at least I think the people they've elected have been horrific, but they've done the job that they were elected to do. They did exactly what they wanted them to do, whether it's, you know, passing tax cuts or naming tons of conservative judges to pack the bench. They're doing what they were elected to do, and we still don't know what the Democrats are about.
Well, and that's it. You know, it's several early in Trump's presidency, I do a lot of work in Germany, and a German think tank asked me to, you know, explain Trump. And I said, you know, and I wrote a piece of the oddly coherent political philosophy of Donald Trump, because people think he's like erratic and crazy, and he is, no question of that.
Mm-hmm.
But do you know what's really coherent? What is delivering on those conservative judges, delivering on conservative social policies, especially as regards education, delivering for the very, very wealthy, delivering for corporate interests.
Yeah.
I mean, he's doing exactly what Mike Pence would do if he could.
Yep.
He's doing exactly what all the other people he beat for the nomination would do if they could. Now, Trump's crazier, more extreme, more frightening, more troublesome from a standpoint of democratic norms. But the bottom line is he'll hold a large portion of his base because he does what they want a Republican president to do. I promise you, if Democrats developed a much more coherent strategy and a more coherent message, if they took risks and if they aimed toward the future, you know, saying we're gonna address the necessary issues now, and maybe we'll lose an election now and again, but boy, when we get power, we're gonna do it.
Yeah,
you'd be shocked by how loyal masses of voters.
I agree.
Many, many more voters would become.
And I think that's why Bernie Sanders hit such a chord with so many people around the country, because he is a man of action. He's got big ideas, and he's not afraid to say it and to be the progressive that he is. John Nichols, I want to ask you, you put Henry Wallace in the title, in the subtitle of the book. It's The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Policies. You know, when we think of the FDR administration, we think of FDR. We may even think of Francis Perkins. But Henry Wallace was not exactly a household name. Many of us believe he should be more so, and so I'm glad you're elevating him here. For those who don't know much about Henry Wallace, because after all, vice presidents in history never got a whole lot of attention, who was Henry Wallace and why should we be talking about him now?
Well, Henry Wallace was a great campaigner for the agricultural, community in this country. He came out of farm country, born in rural Iowa. He edited a farm publication and was actually a liberal Republican. Mm. They used to have those.
Uh-huh.
And Franklin Roosevelt went out and met with him in the early 1930s, where they talked to each other, got to know each other. And Roosevelt convinced Wallace to campaign for him in 1932 on a promise that they would revitalize farm country. Wallace did that, and when Roosevelt became president, he made Wallace his Secretary of Agriculture. In those days, the Department of Agriculture was the dynamic force. This is where the big New Deal ideas spun out of.
Mm-hmm.
And Wallace became a hero, not just to, you know, impoverished farmers and people in rural areas. He became a hero to the unions, to, you know, all sorts of folks, because he had been such a dynamic, passionate New Dealer. Roosevelt made him vice president in 1940 because he wanted to, you know, move the party and the ticket to the left. There was no question of that. Roosevelt was clear about that. And Wallace came in and was an incredibly dynamic vice president, but incredibly controversial.
Hmm.
1943, when there was a race riot in Detroit, he flew to Detroit and spoke to a mass rally of union members, African-Americans, Latinos, and white workers. And he said to them that racism, that, you know, the violence that extended from racism was a form of Americanized fascism.
Uh-huh.
He essentially said to them, if you are against the Nazis, right, if you're against what's going on overseas, then you cannot accept this here at home.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that kind of talk in 1943 earned him a lot of enemies. The Southern segregationists got furious at him, and they were still a huge force in the party. The bankers and the big city bosses didn't like him because he was very pro-union. The New York Times criticized him. They said he was dividing the country during the war effort. And a big effort was made to push him off the ticket. Roosevelt let an open convention go forward in 1944. And on the first ballot, Wallace won. But they then maneuvered successfully to push him aside.
You mean the superdelegates? Superdelegates came into play?
He wasn't quite superdelegates in those days. Actually, the story, it's a chapter in the book. It's an incredible story. He came to Chicago. They wouldn't let him, the bosses wouldn't let him speak at the convention. Finally, they said, well, you can second Roosevelt's nomination. He gave a speech that was so powerful, so exciting, so energizing, that the convention went wild.
Wow.
And there was a huge demand to renominate him. And finally, as the night went on and the passion for renominating him got stronger, there was an effort by Claude Pepper, who was then the senator from Florida.
Yeah.
He was rushing to the stage to to call for a vote by acclamation to renominate Wallace for vice president. If he'd gotten to the stage, it would have succeeded. There's no doubt of that. But the bosses gaveled the convention out of order. They shut it down rather than allow the vote. And they delayed. They then changed all the tickets to the convention. They,
Chuck Schumer
barred all kinds of people who had been there.
Wow.
And nominated somebody else the next day.
I didn't know Chuck Schumer was that old.
Yeah, it wasn't Chuck Schumer.
I know. I'm just kidding.
It was. And this is the tragedy of it.
Yeah.
It was big city bosses, southern segregationists, and people who were tied to the bankers. And it was late night. It was well into 1944. They knew Franklin Roosevelt was an aging president with a lot of health problems. Mm-hmm. They were quite conscious of the possibility that Roosevelt would die. And they wanted to make sure that the person who succeeded him would take them backward, not forward, i.e. And that didn't mean get rid of the whole New Deal. These were extreme right-wingers, except some of the segregationists. But some of the big city bosses were not that bad, you know, some of their politics. But they just didn't want that great forward push. They didn't want to keep on fighting, if you will. And the end result was that they severely weakened the party. The truth is they lost their congressional power in 46. In 48, Truman was reelected. And Wallace ran as an independent and failed miserably. Mm. And, you know, so the party was torn apart. But Truman survived in 48. But here's the important thing to understand. By, you know, 49 into 50, Truman was weakened severely. He was defeated in, or he wasn't defeated. He, you know, stood down in 1952. Democrats lost the presidency. They lost Congress. They would, you know, sometimes struggle back in that. But, I mean, the party was a party that had been on an incredible roll, right, doing everything with the New Deal, ended up, you know, as an incredibly weakened party that in many ways lost its focus. And sometimes it found its focus along the way. There's no question, 1964, an incredible victory. And what did you get? Now, just to give you an example of what I'm talking about here. In 1964, Lyndon Johnson didn't look to his right, but looked to his left to choose a vice president, chose Hubert Humphrey, and ran not a conservative campaign, but a bold and very, very progressive-focused campaign. And what did you get from Lyndon Johnson in that period? Constitutional amendment to eliminate the poll tax,
right?
The Civil Rights Act,
right?
The Voting Rights Act,
that's right.
Medicare,
yep.
Medicaid,
yep.
The war on poverty,
yep. Yep.
The launch
that's
of
right.
many of our initial consumer protections, the launch of many of our initial environmental protections, and we even got public broadcasting. So, I mean, this is what happens when you actually try.
Right.
You know, it's not that complicated.
Right. And Johnson would be recognized, I think, as one of our great progressive presidents, if not for the Vietnam War.
And that's one of the key elements that I focus on in the book, because what Wallace preached back in the 1940s was that you had a twofold responsibility. You had to address the fundamental structural challenges at home. Mm-hmm. That included structural racism, structural sexism. And he was talking about this in the 40s.
Yeah,
and he said you got to address these things at home, but you also have to focus on trying to achieve peace internationally. You have to focus, and this is a guy who's a big supporter of World War II, but he didn't want another war, and he didn't want a Cold War. He said you got to look at diplomacy and, you know, better international relations and better efforts at cooperation. Why? It was very, very simple. He said if you start to get involved in all sorts of wars abroad, you're going to end up in a situation where you cannot maintain the progress at home.
Hmm.
He anticipated many of the things that A. Philip Randolph and ultimately the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. said about, you know, 1967, King's incredible speech on, you know, the Vietnam War and what it was costing us at home. And so these are not new concepts. This idea that you have to have a very strong and very focused domestic and foreign policy that is aimed toward a coherent goal. And that coherent goal is to achieve progress at home and abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And it is possible. But you can't do it just casually, and you can't just, you know, flip from election to election, you know, hoping that everything's going to turn out fine.
Gotcha.
No, that's why we consider ourselves a political party.
Yes. One last question for you, John Nichols. Does the book Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party have a happy ending?
It does. I end up, the last line is, one of Wallace's great struggles was in Detroit, where he did fight, you know, spoke out against racism incredibly effectively. And while writing the book, I went to Detroit with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Uh-huh.
And we talked about the future of the Democratic Party. And the last line of the book, she's talking about the era that when Roosevelt and Wallace were fighting for an economic bill of rights and beginning to scope out, you know, these much broader, bolder visions for the post-World War II era. And she said, I want to be that party again.
Mm. All right. Speaker AOC and eventually President AOC. I think that's the way we need to go.
She's young enough to be bold.
She certainly is. All right. John Nichols, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. What a great way to end a really lousy week. Thank you so much for being here. The book is The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, The Enduring Legacy of Henry Wallace's Anti-Fascist, Anti-Racist Politics. John Nichols, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Honored to be with you, Nicole.
For me too. Thank you. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
You too.
All right. And with that, we're done for the week. That's the week. Monday, we are back. Yes, we're doing Music Mondays. And in fact, I've got an announcement of sorts to make on Monday, where I'm co-branding the Monday Music Show with my friend Michelle Clark and her Sunset Sessions. So hopefully it'll turn into even better things. So just because I can't be all politics all the time because it's making me nuts. So enjoy your weekend. Stay safe. Don't get too cocky and overconfident. Wear a mask. You know, don't touch your face, all that stuff. And stay home if you can. All right? Because I want you back here next week. Thanks again. I'll see you Monday. And just take care of yourself, okay? All right. Bye, everyone.